Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
Hey, Amber, how you doing?
Great, how are you?
I'm overwhelmed and overworked, but I'm okay. And I'm, you know, the podcasts are like a strange relief from email and administrative duties, and they allow me to think about, you know, the topics that I was trained for, which is really nice. So yeah, yesterday I did another podcast about Cleopatra, and today we're going to do another one about Cleopatra. So I think Cleopatra is on the mind for whatever reason. And both of you suggested these things independently. So I feel that I'm going to go with it. And yeah, it's awesome.
Hopefully people aren't getting tired of Cleopatra. But there's a lot to say.
There's so much to say, because Cleopatra's story is the misogyny of the patriarchal world in narrative historical form. And that's why it's so very useful to work with from a feminist perspective. But we're going to focus on one tiny portion, but very important element of her story, which is her death and how she died, the manner of her death, and really try to unpack, as the scholars say, all of the different perspectives and assumptions about Cleopatra's death, and try to come to a maybe more nuanced understanding of how these stories of her death are transmitted, what that cultural memory means that we then carry and hold, and what some alternatives could be.
Right. And I was thinking about it as you're speaking, we're really in a way dealing with the Western cultural memory of Cleopatra, right?
Absolutely. This is Roman sources and Greek sources, or Greco-Roman sources, but really anything that's written in Greek is for the same Roman imperial world. The other sources that one could look at, Arabic sources in particular, present Cleopatra in a very different light, as a freedom fighter, a Boudica, a Zenobia, fighting against a rapacious Roman Empire and losing, a woman who was educated and who put her brilliance towards healthcare matters, beautification matters, but she was considered a kind of scientist in her way, erudite and documenting her experiments in healthcare. And her memory really survives in Arabic sources as an unusual woman able to invent unusual health remedies, particularly for skincare. And if that sounds frivolous to you, I would advise you to think hard upon skincare in the ancient world, or think of your best friend who has eczema or some horrible skin malady. This is not something to joke around with. And it would have been very, very important for the ancient world as much as the modern. So she's considered this freedom fighting scientist badass in the other sources. And obviously much more work is being done on that now. And the Western mind as a collective is now being exposed to those ideas, which is really cool. But we're going to try to unpack the Roman stories of her death and use our detective skills, our understanding of the situation on the ground, and ask if these are assumptions, if there's any alternatives to this story.
Right. And we're relying on the Roman sources because we should remind people, we have nothing from Cleopatra. No real Egyptian sources, right? Aside from
no narrative sources, to
yeah,
be
no
sure.
Sources.
No, we have the image of her and her son at Dendera. You have statues that might have belonged to Cleopatra. You have coinage, things produced by her, but in the typical Egyptian way, her story is told in an idealizing manner. It's told in a perfecting manner. That's how authoritarians run things. They're not going to include letters or speeches or any sort of information that provides a human nuance or any sort of drama. And the Roman political situation, and this is something I make very clear in the classroom, is very different from the Egyptian political situation. It's a more competitive political situation in which talking openly about competitors was not only useful, but necessary. So you have people giving speeches about the many lovers of Mark Antony, or you and all of his strain beyond the marriage bed, one might say. Or you have people talking about Julius Caesar and making suggestions about an alternative sexual identity or health weaknesses. And so you have rulers presented with foibles by other competitive rulers. And in Egypt or any other authoritarian state, you don't have anything like that from internal sources. You only have those dissections of a person's character from the outside. And particularly in this case, from an outside culture that glories in this kind of dissection of a human character. And Cleopatra's character is indeed flayed alive. It is cut from stem to stern and really just carved into tiny bits. And by the time you're done, there's nothing left of the great queen of Egypt, which is why when I wrote my chapter in When Women Ruled the World, I said I openly at the very beginning, I'm not including the Roman sources as they apply to her character. I will use the Roman sources as they apply to events that we are pretty sure happened, but I'm not going to do a character assassination, and I'm going to treat her as I treat the other female rulers in the book, as I treat Hatshepsut, whose sources are all positive and idealizing and perfected, and we can't expect anything else. Same for maybe Tawasra. It is a little bit different if she was removed from the throne. Nefertiti is pretty much all idealizing. There's some little interesting tidbits here and there, but I wanted to treat Cleopatra in the same way that the other Egyptian rulers were treated.
Yeah, an interesting point that you make there. And also, when the Roman historians are discussing Cleopatra as a person or personality, you do get the sense that they really are kind of enjoying it. Like, girlfriend, let me tell you. And then they sort of get into it. You get this sense that they really are having fun imparting all of this information to you about, oh, this is what we think that this woman was like. So they are fun to read in that way.
Yeah. So if you have texts about her drama filled emotional life and her upheaval and or her seductress abilities to control two great Roman warlords who shouldn't otherwise have been controlled, they apply the same imaginative thinking to her death and the details in which it occurred. And this is where it gets really interesting, because some say it was the bite of a snake. Some people say, and we're going to get into the details in more detail, but some people say it was a poison. But in each case, each author includes details as if they were there, mm-hmm. includes these details of a dramatic narrative that make the listener of the tale feel as if it is real. Because what else makes somebody feel like this actually happened but the verity of the story, with little details that you could only know if you had a first-person account, little notions of what time of day it occurred at, or what she was wearing, or, you know, what servants were there, what was said. And those things may differ from account to account, but in each case, they do try to include those factual or true-to-life sorts of details.
Yeah, it's as close as the ancient Roman historians got to citations. Like, it was the idea of, okay, as you say, the more detail, they presume that that would indicate more veracity, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and yet they're different. And yet these accounts are all different. So what are we?
They are. That's what I was just about to ask you. What is the general arc of the story of the suicide of Cleopatra?
Well, let's see, do I want to read this one first? Okay, yes. So we first have Livy. And in Livy, Cleopatra tells him, I will not be led in a triumph. And then in Livy, we are to understand that he says that if she does, he won't kill her, right? And then we have a spy telling Cleopatra, or some sort of person working for her telling Cleopatra, that she's going to be paraded in a triumph. And that's when she kills herself to avoid this spectacle of her being dragged.
Right. So Livy, his perspective is that she prioritized this idea of she absolutely was not going to allow herself to be led in a triumph in the city of Rome.
Right. Too demeaning, too problematic for the queen that she was. And so she avoids this humiliation. And we should get into the details of that humiliation part. The humiliation is interesting. It creates a woman who is willing to selfishly remove herself from a situation because she actually can't handle the emotional burden that it would place upon her personally. And she's willing to exit a situation and leave her children and her country to their fate because she can't handle the emotional burden that this would place upon her. So it's a story that, in my opinion, tells that she's taking the easy way out, that she can't handle this burden that we have to assume Roman audiences would have been accustomed to. This is a Rome that was ever expanding, and they would have seen in triumphs the leaders of opposing armies and countries and polities and places and cities paraded through their streets. This was something that they were accustomed to seeing, and they would have seen and discussed some of those rulers walking through with head held high as best they could, others degraded and weeping or whatever. But it's something that they would use to assign a certain character to a certain ruler. And Cleopatra opting out of that dissection completely is then perceived as a weakling who can't take it, who can't take what defeat gives you. And when you're defeated, she just takes the easy way out and that's it. Now, you might say, push back and be like, well, no, because Mark Antony kills himself too and da-da-da. But this is about the humiliation in particular. She kills herself because of the humiliation. She's not killing herself like Antony after a battle that she's lost in humiliating fashion, taking the hero's way out, killing herself with her own hand in that way with a sharp blade. It's a different kind of statement from my perspective.
I would put it two things out here. I absolutely co-sign on the avoidance of the humiliation motivation, but could it also have been seen as she was that prideful and vain that she was simply not going to allow that? She is the queen of Egypt, and her pride and her vanity would not allow for that. So there's that other side of the coin as well. And I was thinking, too, when you were talking, we know Antony committed suicide. He killed himself with his sword, according to the Roman sources. He can claim the hero's death, but I think that even if Cleopatra had used a sword or done something a little bit more Roman, could she have even claimed it in that way? Because she was female, also not Roman, and as Octavian's propaganda loved to reiterate over and over again, orientalizing her and making her seem like the other.
I think it's important to dwell on the fact that suicide for a woman in a patriarchal society is often perceived differently as suicide for a man. And let's just put it into a modern, let's look at it through a modern lens. If you read in the newspaper about a man killing his wife and children and then turning the weapon upon himself, you're like, oh, okay, I understand this. It's that masculine rage. She's leaving him and taking the children. And so he can't keep them. So he kills them all and then kills himself. It's like losing a battle, Mark Antony style, and then taking yourself out. It's something that in patriarchal terms, we understand as this scorched earth policy in which even love and partnership is a battle, right? But for a woman to do the same, and to then, when you read in the papers or whatever, you're reading in the news, a woman killing her children and then killing herself, it hits within our cultural appreciation very differently. It hits as a woman who is committing the ultimate sin of not caretaking her children, caretaking her home, her domestic space. She is taking the easy way out. And add to that, I'm not saying that we don't perceive the guy as mentally unstable. We certainly do. But I think we assign more of a patriarchal understanding of a lost battle to that narrative, whereas the woman is destroying that which she should love the most. She should be sacrificing her labor, her body, her emotions for this family, for her children, to kill those children. And we have Greeks writing plays about this. I mean, this is probably the most horrific sin that a woman can commit. And so killing herself and leaving her children and her people, who are her children writ large, to their fate is putting her into that light of the hysterical woman who is not fighting a battle, who should submit to this noble path, and yet she can't handle it. Her brain is cracked. Her brain and body are somehow broken, and she has to remove herself from the situation. So that's the way I see a woman's suicide versus a man's. It's much less about the battle won or lost, and much more about the emotions that overwhelm her body and soul that she can't handle. This is a very oversimplified discussion of a much larger topic, but it's an interesting thing how that suicide hits differently for a woman with children. If we're talking about a woman who doesn't have children, a woman who is killing herself so that she doesn't have to marry a heathen and becomes a martyr, that's perhaps a different thing. Or a woman who's been raped and then kills herself. That's a battle that she's lost and then she has to kill herself. This is different. This is a woman who should be caretaking and sucking it up, and she doesn't do that. So yeah,
those different scenarios just give you such an idea of how convoluted the patriarchy is and the patriarchal reasoning behind the perception of each of these things. When you take a step back, it just seems so insane that,
yeah,
you know, they could be rationalized in such different ways.
Women and girls know anything like this can be taken this way. You can dress in the same thing as a man and you'll be treated
absolutely
differently. You can speak up and you'll be treated completely differently. You can get angry and you'll be treated completely differently. These things are not unexpected. But then the next author we have is Plutarch.
Plutarch's the next one that is more familiar to the popular imagination. There are several different historians mm-hmm. that discuss her death, but Plutarch, his account is one of the ones that people would be most familiar with.
Right. And it seems to be what's used in the Elizabeth Taylor film, which mm-hmm. I just watched parts of. But there's a lot of elaboration in this narrative, including a very elaborate bath that's taken, a bath with all of the milks and creams and herbs and things. So she's going to go out with an ostentatious style, even if it's just for herself, even if it's an audience of one and or three with her handmaidens and that kind of thing. But it's very carefully done, we are told. And she has a beautiful last meal, we are told. So she treats her body as the most important thing in this narrative, and then she destroys that same body.
Plutarch leans hard into this idea of the luxurious, almost wastefully luxurious East, the exact opposite of a practical Roman approach to things, right? Roman takes out his sword, commits suicide. Cleopatra is taking an almost ritualistic bath and preparing her body, as you say, for this last act.
Yeah. And we have more information about how she's guarded to prevent a suicide. And I love this. So Octavian's like, don't let her commit suicide. I need her
he's
for my...
He's trying to stop her. He's trying to protect her and keep her from doing this.
She's the unstable one. And he's trying to do the good manly deed of keeping her alive and is guarding her so that she won't commit suicide. He's the good hero trying to keep her alive for the Egyptian people or... It's not just to keep her alive for a triumph, I don't think. It's that he's said to be trying to do the right thing, right? And yet, all of these things they don't work. And here we get to her craftiness, right? Her deception, ability to deceive. Yes. She writes some letter and saying, oh, I want this or that. He's like, okay, sure. But she writes a letter saying that she wants to be buried next to Antony. And that's when they realize that she's able to pull it off. How is she able to get the letter out? How is she able to get the suicide completed if she's being guarded? But she, we are told, is just this crafty, amazing thing. And it gives you a sense of this witch-like character who's able to get the nefarious done, even when she's being guarded by the people of the light.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we have the story, according to Plutarch, that the messengers get this letter. They rush to the door. It's all too late. And she's there dead already. So it's a story about her taking the easy way out. Neither Livy nor Plutarch, it seems, gives the details of where this is happening, but we have the story of an ostentatious way out.
Some of the Roman sources discuss her retreat, her wanting to be in her tomb retreating to that space. There's another Roman historian, Cassius Dio. He talks about after she had been bitten by a snake, whether it's an asp or an Egyptian cobra, Cassius Dio is like, Octavian tries to save her even then, bringing in snake charmers who try to suck out the poison and still save her life even after she's done this to herself. Again, sort of this familiar thread in the Roman sources of Octavian just trying to do the right thing here, but she keeps pushing and pushing and using deception eventually just to simply get her way.
Yeah. And the amount of writing that these Roman authors put into the different ways of dispatch are pretty extraordinary. So we have the snake, the asp, the poisonous mm-hmm. snake, which seems to be the most common, but is by no means the only option that we have here. And you even have, you know how when we go to conferences, Amber, and there's like always that doctor or physician who's looked at the Edwin Smith papyrus and then needs to give their own medical opinion on how this would have worked with diagnoses, etc. Well, it seems that Galen, who was a Roman physician and wrote treatises about how to treat people, did the same and came up with its own medical theory that he's like, oh, okay, so she may have bit Cleopatra, he says, bit her own arm to get the venom into the wound. So he as a physician is like, well, getting bitten by the snake isn't enough to kill her in my medical opinion. So he thinks that she must have then created a cut into which the poison was introduced. And that's the way that she would have died. But then there's doubts about this. Like Suetonius is not sure about the snake thing and expresses that opinion. Plutarch is all about the snake. Strabo, I think, is about the snake. Cassius Dio, apparently discusses the puncture wounds, but doesn't go further into the snake thing and says that we're not really sure. And then who's talking about the different ways of trying out poisons? Which author is that? Do you know?
I believe I was quickly scanning that. I think that was in Plutarch, or it is in Plutarch.
Okay.
But I think it's in Parallel Lives, not in Antony, because he's got a couple of different texts in which he discusses the death of Cleopatra. But
right.
I mean, the overarching point that we're trying to make here is that these sources are kind of a mess. Like they
yes.
all have
yes.
the common thread, I think, is that she commits suicide. The
yes.
entire story of what was the lead up to it? How did it happen? What was the ultimate outcome? How did people react? Cassius Dio talks about Octavian was rageful that he was denied this opportunity to parade her in a triumph in Rome. Other sources don't really address that kind of thing. And so these historians, you know, you almost get the sense that they're just like, oh, this is the story that I like. These are the mm-hmm. details that I like. And here you go.
Yeah. And so the listener may notice that we're not as interested in this part, that, you know, we're going through the motions. And trust me, there's a ton written. There's treatises written about how she committed suicide and comparing the different methods and actually engaging a little bit of experimental work to try to determine how she may have killed herself. But I when I wrote about this in When Women Rule the World, in that chapter on Cleopatra, I transcend it. And I just say a whole lot has been written about this. It disagrees or agrees in some places. But as you say, Amber, the main through line is suicide, that she takes her own life and she does so in a deceptive, sneaky way. She does so in an ostentatious, dramatic, over-the-top way. And there are many, and I don't remember which author, but there's also the selfishness materially in which she is said to bring her riches from around the world, around her Egyptian world, pulling them into her mausoleum that she is intent upon destroying. So she's not only going to kill herself, she's going to kill all of the things that come with her, which is very much like the man killing his wife and children and then dispatching himself. Like she's going to take it all. And so there's this ostentatious display, even at the very end. And I do believe is it Plutarch? Who is it where she's there all decked out in her,
that's
in
Plutarch.
Her beautiful garments?
And yeah. even with her diadem, yeah.
Mm-hmm. and her crowns and her best garments and all of these things. So when she's found arranged very carefully. Even in death, she dies idealized and perfected. And so we get that tension between the Roman world where a ruler's foibles and humanity is exposed and communicated to the public, but the Egyptians are not. And they work with that. It's a very clever way of saying, oh, perfected even at the end, but we know she wasn't perfect, but look at how she's trying to make it seem so. And that's a really interesting way of looking at that. But then, okay, so we've got the suicide and we've discussed what a suicide potentially means when you're the mother of very important children and the larger mother of a populace of people who are now going to be gobbled up by the Roman imperial machine. What if the suicide didn't happen?
That's just what I was going to ask. We're talking about how little these Roman historians can be trusted as far as their accounts go. Did she really die by suicide? Was she murdered?
So some people might be like, how can you even talk about this and claim that there wasn't necessarily a suicide? Well, I would say that we're dealing with a situation in which a polity has just been defeated and in which you want to move that polity into your grasp as easily as possible. And it's a particular polity. It's the state of Egypt that is something that no Roman warlord has been allowed to claim. And the first one that put his legions there, Julius Caesar, he was killed for it. It's too much power in the hands of one man. Mark Antony, he tries to claim it and use all of this grain and gold to fund his armies. And he is defeated in battle for it. Now we have Octavian claiming it and understanding that it will change the very way that Rome, it works as a government. And Rome has been embroiled in civil wars for the last century. But the rule of Octavian and the taking of the wealth and power that Egypt provides, that is going to move Rome into what we call the Principate, with the princeps at the head of society. It's as imperial as it ever was, but the way it is ruled is a different beast. And given that, he cannot allow a ruler of Egypt to remain alive. He needs to make Rome into a province. He needs to take it, put a governor there, have that governor report directly to him, and make sure that all of the wealth and riches are funneled to him. But what the Romans had done is keep a Ptolemy alive, keep the kingship and the dynasty going, allow them to launder money and power and legal decisions through this dynasty and through these rulers who were very much beholden to Rome in terms of legal power, political power, military power, certainly economic power as well. And so the death of Cleopatra was a small thing for him. If he murders her and she's killed and then he takes it, it smacks of a different kind of claim. Then he's just claiming it outright, and he is displaying that claim openly to his Roman competitors. He kills Cleopatra, the land is mine, ha ha, he's holding the bloody knife and it's all there. That looks bad. It looks very problematic from his perspective.
Yeah, I was just going to say, should remind people that Octavian, remember, he becomes Augustus Caesar, and he was very much preoccupied with this idea of people perceiving him as a moral figure. He wanted that moral authority. He wanted the right on his side. And his propaganda campaign against Antony and Cleopatra, it is, I think, up until that point, relatively unprecedented. And so he is very concerned about the image that he's projecting to the Roman public and just, you know, people at large and the people of Egypt, I would assume, unless he wants
to. And he will pass sumptuary laws saying that you can't display ostentatiously in your clothing and your body adornment. He will put these morals of the good Roman man forward. And really, it's pushing against the over the top losing of oneself from the Roman perspective of men like Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, who were these good, strong men, but they became just undone by the bewitching of this place and this woman. And so he has to separate himself from that.
Yes, that he has the strong moral character.
Exactly. So let's imagine that he just goes in and he says, oh, I had her killed and now Egypt is mine. All of the competitors in the Senate will be like, what the hell? Now he's doing exactly what the other guys did. And he will be putting himself into that light of taking something that is so very problematic. But if he says she killed herself and he's like, oh my God, I tried to stop her and I can't believe that this happened, that she dispatched herself like this. I just don't know what to say, but now I have to, you know, I just have to take it.
Yeah, I was going to say, this jewel fell in my lap. What else am I supposed to do? You know, I've been left with no other choice. But can we also contrast this with Caesarion? Mm-hmm. Because the historical accounts seem to agree on that point. He was murdered. He was taken out. And it seemed that Octavian wasn't disturbed by that storyline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the storyline is also, and again, I don't know exactly which author this is, who says that Caesarion was going down to Ethiopia and then turned back. Which one is it? I think it's multiple accounts. But this story that he's like, oh, I'm on my way to Ethiopia and I'm going to go to India and I'm going to be safe there. And then he hears something, apparently a false letter is sent. And Caesarion is like, oh, I can go back to Alexandria. And he starts on the road back, and it's on the way back that he's killed. It's another way of saying the jewel fell in my lap, if you like. It's like, look, the boy is so stupid that he fell for what we fed him and started coming back to Alexandria. And so really, we just had to kill him. But it also points out that killing a man is very different from killing a woman in the eyes of the Roman populace whom he is trying to please. Mm-hmm. So killing,
that's an excellent point.
And even killing a boy, right? So Caesarion at this point is no tiny child. He's a teenager in age. And so, you know, he's killable. And killing a masculine entity is very different from killing a feminine one. And killing a beautiful queen is a problem. It doesn't make him look the way he wants to look. So the suicide, it serves him so well to create this narrative of a selfish woman taking the easy way out. It serves him so well to say that he didn't have anything to do with it. She was intent in her sneaky, devious ways of doing it. And he tried to keep her alive. And we don't know then what his intentions would have been with her after the triumph. But would he have put direct rule there? Would he have let her go back to Egypt? It's not completely clear, but he doesn't even have to say. This is not something he even has to entertain. He doesn't have to talk about. The problem no longer exists because she's gone. And so I guess for me, the main point of Cleopatra's story is that it is when she loses the Battle of Actium, it is shortly after that, that she dies. How she dies, we can argue till we're blue in the face, but instead of arguing about methods of suicide, and taking this assumption as absolute gospel truth, just because some Roman guys told us in different texts, I would like us to look at the mess, as you call it, of different methods of suicide and say, oh, they doth protest too much. It's like there's so much about the suicide that we were all intrigued by the shiny thing over here. And we don't notice that over there is the possibility that she was just outright killed. And that would have served him better. And killing her and then overlaying it with the veneer of a suicide is the most clever propagandistic methodology that I think I've ever seen. And then to see how he's able to funnel all of Rome's political, military, and economic wealth to himself and create this institution of princeps. I mean, it all falls in line from my perspective. Will I ever know this for certain? No. Do we have a time machine that we can go back in time and check? No, but would it even work? Do we know how Jeffrey Epstein how he died? No. Suicide is used in all kinds of ways to cover up dispatches that are problematic for men in high places. And I think that very few people believe that Jeffrey Epstein actually killed himself, that there was something else going on there and cameras are all turned off. And I think it's a useful comparison. I really do, because then you've got, in each case, you've got a figure. They may not be sympathetic. Jeffrey Epstein is by no means sympathetic. Cleopatra for the Roman people is by no means sympathetic, but they talk and could talk.
Oh, it's a great story.
Still secrets. And tell things about other people that nobody wants to know, or that the ruler in charge doesn't want them to know, and just creates problems. So just kill them and say, oh, they took the easy way out, and then that's it.
And human nature has not changed very much. You talk about this story of Cleopatra being this shiny thing that distracts the Roman public from the fact that Octavian is slowly stepping toward becoming Augustus Caesar. And then in our own modern culture, we have all of these culture wars happening. You need to worry about who can go in the public bathroom, and never mind the politicians over here, the billionaires over here, amassing more and more wealth and power. And, you know, don't talk about the real problems. Let's talk about our public bathrooms, the libraries in the schools, and which books they carry. And doesn't this make you angry or upset you so much?
Yeah.
It just it distracts people over here while the people in power over there are doing their thing.
It's so important, as you say, to remind ourselves that this is the moment that Roman power is being distilled into the body of one person. And that this these emperors that we talk about with all of their human foibles that are exposed to our gaze in Roman sources, that this is created at this moment. And that this dispatch of Cleopatra and the taking of Egypt is what makes and turns Rome into this other thing. And that it is a particular man who's doing this. It's Octavian, who's very cleverly using the stories of Cleopatra, whether they be her dramatic outbursts or her witchcraft or her suicide. It's a way to build a story that he's the only one that can save Rome, which is such an authoritarian trope, right? Mark Antony was undone. Julius Caesar was undone. All of these other great men who went in with the best of intentions, they couldn't handle themselves against this great power. And in Octavian, the suicide's useful this way, because he can say, look, even I couldn't defeat her. She killed herself, even though I had the guards there and I was all ready to make sure that she was paraded in this way. And even I couldn't do it. But he's not a man to be deceived. Well, he can be deceived by her, but he can't be undone by her. And so he's the only one that can save the Roman men from themselves, and thus the only good one left. And all of these, even the stories of Mark Antony's suicide and how he does it, I dare say, we should also take with a grain of salt. Yes, his is a hero's death. And why do we doubt Cleopatra's not his? It's completely possible he killed both of them. And it's just like, okay, now we're done. But the suicide story works so well to put him on a different plane of nobility and morality and truth-telling and it's a brilliant way to take Egypt from the men who had been trying to take it before him.
Right. So I think what we're ultimately getting to here is that it doesn't necessarily matter exactly what manner of death Cleopatra and Antony had. What matters is what happened after their death, how their deaths were used. And I have to also think that even if it doesn't matter whether or not they committed suicide, whether or not they were murdered, I think the important thing is that we have this discussion, because it puts your perspective in a very different place to question the ancient sources so thoroughly.
And it makes you realize that there is
mind.
No, yeah, there is no truth with a capital T.
Right.
That history is always told by the victors, that there's always an agenda. You can write the most careful biography of Cleopatra and include all of the sources and go through them in a fine, careful way, but it doesn't necessarily tell you the story you want to hear. And that is also why an alternative outside perspective is so useful. We have the Egyptological, non-classical perspective, my perspective, a Bronze Age perspective. And then you might have the Middle Eastern perspective, an Arabic perspective, but Arabic as written in the text, but it's certainly more of a larger Middle East perspective. And looking at those perspectives are the most likely to look at the Roman sources as a block and discard them as a propagandistic block and not get lost in the weeds and be like, wait, Cassius Dio says this and Livy says that, but Plutarch says this. And what about Galen biting her arm and all this stuff? It's easier when you're coming in from the outside to recognize the propaganda for what it is and recognize it as serving Octavian in the way that it does. And then discarding it as so self-serving that one has to be leery of the whole group, of all of it, and entertain different ideas, different narratives that we'll actually never really know. But also to do the basic historical detective work of asking, who were the characters on the ground? What would their agendas have been? What were the circumstances at the time? No, there was no princeps yet. This is being created. No, Egypt hadn't been taken into the empire yet. This is happening now. And to try to put ourselves into that time and space and to ask, what would a ruler do? How would this serve them? And instead of falling into the trap of teleology, of looking at this story from the perspective of an established Roman Empire rather than a Roman Empire that's being formed in the moment.
Right. I think that the usefulness in the discussion is it changes the way we look at the historical sources and how we ultimately consider them. Because let's even put out there this imaginary scenario in which, say, we have a Cleopatra account or even just simply an Egyptian textual account in some way. We couldn't put our full faith in that either, but we could contrast it with the Roman sources. We would have, as you say, something else to go from that wasn't a Roman perspective. And so even if we did have her full account of what led up to her downfall, we're still going to be missing something. But I think it's still a fascinating situation to consider, because you're right.
And
I
mean, it makes
this was Octavian's step to becoming Caesar.
And it reminds us that you should not use the sources that are meant for one audience to tell the story for another group of people. These stories are meant for a Roman audience. They have a Roman edge and a Roman meaning and a Roman purpose. They're there for the elites of Rome to create certain opinions about the situation. And many of them were written long after these events took place. They're there to defend and redefend the creation of an authoritarian regime, to the creation essentially of a kingship that they're not calling a kingship. This is to me one of the most important points, that Octavian, while he accuses Cleopatra of such ultimate deception, the story that he's telling about her life and death, or the story that his propagandists tell about her life and death, is veiling his own deception of being a king and creating a kingship and a dynasty while saying that he's not a king. That's a hell of a lot of subterfuge, and it's an extraordinary feat to get away with. So extraordinary that many of us don't even recognize it as such. We use the term emperor. We use the word princeps, the first among many. But he's created a kingship. It doesn't always necessarily follow a dynastic family lineage, but it does in many cases. And it's one man at the tip of a spear. So how do you do that? How do you create a kingship while saying kingship is bad? Kingship is evil. This Cleopatra story is a brilliant way of showing how monarchy is evil, and yet you're the good one that's saving everyone from it while you're doing the exact same things that a monarchy does. Pretty crazy. Pretty clever.
It is. It's clever and devious. And like I said, it's a fascinating story. And I think that's why people keep digging into it again and again, because every time you get into it, you maybe get a different perspective. You fall down a different rabbit hole and consider a new path as to maybe what might have happened or why it might have happened. And I think that's why a lot of people are interested in Roman history to begin with, is because we sort of have an embarrassment of riches in a way from the sources and the historians. They are kind of gossipy. There's a certain flavor to them that it's really easy to get sucked in.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is a little TMZ history, though, like a tabloid kind of history in many ways. And a lot of those historians, you alluded to it, but a lot of those Roman historians were patronized by the emperors. Like literally, they may have been getting some income from these rulers. And so, of course, as you say, they're going to toe the line. They're going to help to justify the entire narrative in any way they can to make sure that the gravy train keeps rolling for them.
Let me add one more thing. Authoritarianism usually starts with the call for emergency powers, that things are so bad. And trust me, in Rome at that time, that things must have been really freaking bad. Like there, people are all fighting and armies are being formed and people are being killed all over the Roman imperial stretch of lands. And so with that understanding that emergency powers had to be taken, and he calls himself princeps, one among many, I'm just going to do this for a temporary time period. It's not forever. This is a Pax Romana. He talks about how everything's great. There was probably, and we know there's writings about this, senatorial interest, and the Senate it still exists, that these emergency powers would be disbanded, that we wouldn't continue with this princeps idea, that we would go back to this Republican ideal. And so you need a propaganda that goes to its origins, to its foundation, and makes it pure, makes it perfected, and makes it an unavoidable situation. And so those stories have to be told and retold so that everyone realizes why these emergency powers aren't emergency anymore, why it's going to continue forever, because this is the way human character is. This is the way dynastic monarchies work. It's an extraordinary thing that to maintain a monarchy in Rome, they have to tell and retell horrible stories about monarchs abroad, orientalize them and turn them into bad guys. But that's the way you maintain the monarchy in Rome. And I find that absolutely stunning and so similar to our own political system that I don't know what to say. So we find ourselves in the United States on the cusp of exactly such a turning point of moving from a very messy, very harmful, non-productive political system of competition that is so polarized that nothing happens and people don't have healthcare and borders are open and people are the richest are controlling the masses who don't have anything. And we're moving towards this idea that only these great old men with more powers, more executive powers, more executive actions can save us. And there is at least 50% of this country that wants to go exactly in that direction. One must imagine that Rome was at the same tipping point when Egypt was defeated and that people were having these exact same conversations in the intellectual halls of power. And that's why the stories of the founding fathers of the United States and constitutional originalism, whatever that is, are so very important, because they helped to maintain those people in power. This is one of the Cleopatra's story is a founding moment and has to be treated as such.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to sum up the significance of asking the question, did Cleopatra really commit suicide? But I thought we would end on maybe an interesting little bit of trivia for listeners maybe who've read When Women Ruled the World and talk about, in a way, somewhat of the process you went through producing the book. Every chapter went through a couple of iterations, and the chapter on Cleopatra was pretty important, I think, to the entire book, because I know you excluded the Roman sources, but in theory, there's a lot of information out there about her. That, you know, you had to consider what's going in, what's going out. But you had in that chapter an interesting discussion about Cleopatra in death, what happened to her image, or I don't know how you put it, how she was
legacy perceived.
There you go, legacy. Her legacy after she died. And you made a point of discussing the Isis cult that developed in the Roman world. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, Amber, you just told me that you went through a previous version of the book. Well, so let me give you this story. So I wrote about ISIS cult as being an extension of Cleopatra's martyrdom, or her dispatch by this Roman imperial machine. And I wrote about it and compared it to the Jesus cult, which was rising around, would rise shortly after this, right? A dispatch of another freedom fighter or free thinker, however you want to understand the historical Jesus, but dispatched in a complicated way when we include the internal political discussion, but dispatched by the Roman imperial machine as well. And the legacy of Jesus seems to be much larger than the legacy of Cleopatra, but I also questioned that. So I heard from you just before this podcast started that you had dug into an older version of that chapter and you had found a section that was cut from, and we'll keep it passive voice, that was cut from the book. And would you like to read that for me? And
I definitely want to. I'm going to call you out a little bit about it. But I just want to make the point first about the ISIS cult. Cleopatra as queen of Egypt would have identified very strongly with ISIS, right? And that's
therein
is the connection between Cleopatra and ISIS. So Cleopatra as an ancient Egyptian ruler, female, identifying with ISIS. So it makes total sense that her legacy would involve a continuation of that identification.
Right. She names herself as ISIS during her lifetime. She has statues produced that show her as ISIS during her lifetime. So, yeah.
Right. So I dug up this previous version of your Cleopatra chapter. And it's all at the end of the chapter where you were discussing, as I said, her legacy and what happened after her death. And what you say is, and we'll put this in context here in a minute, the bit of quote that jumped out at me was that you say that Cleopatra was like a female incarnation of Jesus Christ himself. And
this is too much for people. They're like, go on.
And so, yeah, I'm used to reading stuff like this, you know, in your early drafts.
Where I go to the edge of the cliff, I'm like, I'm right at the edge. Maybe I jump. And I jump off the cliff and put it into text. And then it's like,
Len, this is how I'm calling you out a little bit. You are definitely deliberately being provocative there, using that word incarnation.
Yes.
And the full Jesus Christ. Oh. You got it in there. You were like smacking that point home. And I think it jumps out there at the end of the chapter. And I take the point for sure. But I see you lunging for the jugular of the patriarchy.
I like that image that fits. Kind of like Galen saying that Cleopatra bit her own arm or something. But I'm not biting myself. I'm going for the jugular of the patriarchy.
So let me, can I contextualize this
please,
little bit?
Please.
It's part of a bit of a longer paragraph, but I'll keep it to a relatively short portion of the quote. It starts, you say, after her rule and death, the ISIS mystery cult took off like wildfire. In this context, Cleopatra was seen as a protector of her children, of her husband Osiris, of her son Horus. Against all odds, somehow defeating a mighty empire in eternity, kind of like a female incarnation of Jesus Christ himself, a man who lived around the same time, who also fought the great empire and lost.
Ooh, but it got cut.
It got cut. You could have said it in a variety of different ways, but I think the general point stands in that she was a martyr in a sense that was taken down by the Roman Empire, and yet in death had a significance to people.
And so somebody might look at this and be like, the ISIS cult isn't about Cleopatra, you silly scholar or pseudo scholar or whatever you are. And it's not a direct one-on-one comparison. This isn't a cult of Cleopatra. And that way it's very different from the cult of Jesus. But ISIS and the association of ISIS with the mother who sacrifices herself to protect the children. She's not killing herself. But she is sacrificing her own well-being. And in many circumstances of the story, she is a magician. She is a kind of witch. She's able to use that craft to protect her son. The analogy is too good for me to think that intellectuals and people who knew their history did not associate the ISIS story with the Cleopatra story and understand that the empire in which they lived had this voracious appetite to eat up and control and destroy, and to see this cult spreading at the same time the empire is spreading is in some ways perhaps a kind of resistance. Perhaps, I'm not going to say it's anti-patriarchal. I've read The Golden Ass, and I understand that behind ISIS is Osiris, and that once you reach the highest echelons of your initiation, you can see Osiris, and that is revealed to you. And ISIS is just the front man or woman. And so I'm not going to say that this is a feminist religion, but I am going to claim that there is a thread of resistance against empire within this cult, where it is spreading, how it is spreading, even within Rome. That means that people are thinking, what is this system in which we live? Whom does it serve? Who is sacrificed? And how do we understand what a woman's responsibility is in this crazy world of voracious appetite and eating people and polities and cities up so that they can be distilled for the comforts of the elites? This is the Roman Empire of the Book of Revelation. And I do think that everybody was grappling with what they were living in the same way we in the United States are grappling with what does it mean that people have hundreds of billions of dollars and there are homeless people all over the streets of Los Angeles. How do you understand these things and grapple with these incongruities? And the ISIS cult, I really do think, needs to be seen in that light of Cleopatra's martyrdom more specifically.
Right. Well, added to her legacy is the idea that she was the last ruler from within Egypt after Cleopatra.
Indeed.
Egypt is under external rule for centuries.
Yeah.
Up until what, like 1950? I mean, will we go that far? I mean, how?
Yes, you could. Yes, absolutely. Egypt does not have native
rule. I'm sure there are
rule.
People who would argue with that characterization, but.
Potentially. But
in broad Egypt strokes.
But Egypt is not under its own native rule until relatively recently. You're absolutely right. And this is the beginning of that moment for so many different polities around the Mediterranean basin, in North Africa, in West Asia, and in Europe. It's hard, I think, to remember that in Britain, they spoke a different language and they didn't send their kids to private schools or learn Latin. That's the language of their conquerors. It's hard to remember that Germania was anti-Roman too. So everyone is grappling with what it means to be taken over by this. Egypt provides one way, and Cleopatra herself as a martyr provides one way of understanding that massive social shift.
Absolutely. And like I said, you get into Cleopatra and you fall down one rabbit hole after another. And
yeah.
It's a fascinating discussion any way you turn.
And I encourage our listeners to use the sources that are available to them. And there's a ton of stuff online. If you start with just the basics of Wikipedia, and you, as I've said before, I really support Wikipedia. I give Jimmy Wales money because I think it's important that we have this source. It may not be perfect, but it's edited by many. And I think that the idea behind Wikipedia is a wonderful one. And then you can click on different things. And then all of a sudden you're off to reading an original source by Galen, an original source by Livy in translation. And then you can think about a lot of the stuff that we've discussed here and the larger ideas. And there are many biographies out there that are excellent as well. But no one is going to be telling the truth with a capital T. It's not really possible.
Yeah. And I think this discussion really plays into the discussion that we had previously about historiography and can history be apolitical and that sort of thing. This is a drum I love to beat, the whole questioning the source, particularly historical sources, because just putting that question in your mind, it gives you a different perspective. You, instead of being along for the ride when it comes to history, you're actually participating in it in a way because you are coming to your own conclusions.
Yeah.
We're considering the sources on balance and trying to figure out a path through them.
I would make the same argument when reading about modern day political upheaval. And it's why I turn to places like Twitter still, I'm not going to call it that other name, and follow journalists who are going to tell me a different narrative and a different perspective from what I'm going to get in the American propagandistic narrative, because it's towing its own economic and political party line and of the powerful who are trying to obfuscate many things that are happening around the world, things that my own country is engaged in. And so there are many other alternatives out there, but wow, do we have to be careful with who's saying what, how it's being said, whom is it serving, who is the audience, how are things being turned and twisted?
And let's not fool ourselves. The job is getting more and more difficult. We live in an era where we can't even rely on visual evidence like photographs, because they can be so easily manipulated or even outright generated, even voices now.
Which means that, and this is important for our Cleopatra story too, that so much of what ends up telling the truth is the preponderance of data. And so once you're looking on Twitter or some other social media and it's image after image after image, it's not the same doctored image, but it's a different image of these dead people and those dead people and these dead children and that bomb place and this bomb place. Then you're like, oh my God, look at all of this data. And then it becomes, well, it can't be an AI produced thing. This is happening. Or you have video that's happening in real time, which is harder to do, but also in the numbers. And I would say that is probably what the Roman propagandists are trying to create with the preponderance of stories and details and data. They're like, oh, no, it's real. No, it's real. No, it's real. When it's really not. So then it's, as you say, our work is not done. It's a constant battle of how can you find some sort of reasonable storyline trying to get at what really happened with the sources that are available to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the job right now is not easy, but I really have my fingers crossed that we're going to figure this out. There's going to be a way where somehow sources can be watermarked or their origins traced in some way so that they can then be evaluated on their own merits. But I think for the time being, we're in the Wild West.
Yeah.
We're rolling down the Mad Max version of the information highway.
Yeah. Yeah. And so again, it reminds us of what it must have been like to live in the early years of Octavian's Rome as he's creating something new out of whole cloth. And how do you do that? We are back there again.
We are.
So.
Well, that's an uplifting note to end on.
Keeping it real. Always got to keep it real. Resistance comes from someplace, you know.
Well, thanks for indulging this conversation again on Cleopatra.
It was super fun. And I apologize to the listeners for not knowing my Livy from my Plutarch from my whatever, Suetonius. So that'll be up to you to research. But as you see, I decided to just transcend it.
As the academics say, it's not my field.
Exactly. Exactly. So thank you for your patience. And get your Cleopatra research on. It's a fun topic.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see you guys next time on
Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack, Ancient Now, at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for @Karakuni. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.